Rick?
Okay. I'd like just to congratulate Susan and Mark for pulling together all this information. It's, you know, it's always nice when somebody actually bothers to do all the work so that you can then look through and pick it, you know, pick the date and the tables. And so, much obliged. I'm sure all of us will find it useful, you know, as we talk about these things. And I think, Howard, that was a lot of fun. I think you raised good points there and some of the slides. You know, Howard's a guy who actually wants to discuss and actually puts in time and energy and does slides, and there's people like me. I'm just going to share a couple of thoughts, and then we can just talk about this. And I'm sure folks have questions for Mark and Susan. Give them a chance to talk a little bit more at length about some of the work they've done. I just want to hit a couple of general notes. I mean, I think first, you know, what Mark alluded to in his opening remarks was the fact that you're seeing an evolution in labor markets around the industrialized democratic world. That's something that not just the U.S. is dealing with, but everybody else. It plays out differently in different national contexts. The degree to which the entry of women as full-fledged players into the labor force in the last 30 or 40 years in the industrialized world has plays out real differently in different countries. It looks differently, you know, in Korea or in Japan than it does in the U.S. for a variety of reasons. And so I think some of what makes this interesting and complicated is just different countries are trying to figure out how to deal with these labor issues in different ways. You know, the effort to recruit folks into teaching also, kind of what Howard's slides alluded to, is real differently depending on how nations have historically thought about teaching. The degree to which teaching grew out of a unified civil state in a nation, say, like, you know, post-1848 Germany, just has always created a very different context in terms of thinking about the professionalism and compensation of teachers, as opposed to a place like the U.S., where it's always been kind of fragmented and decentralized, you know, like so much of our efforts to reform civil service, you know, say, post-Pendleton Act. So there are these contextual pieces that are going to cut across and that we have trouble thinking about and talking about, and especially so when we don't have any data in front of us. So what's neat about this effort is it gives us a real chance to start to organize and discipline the way we think about the variables at play. But within that, there is this broader trend of an evolving labor market that's taking place really throughout the industrialized world. And one of the things that means is that we need to think about how do we attract and keep the kinds of people we want in classrooms going forward. And in a nation where we've got more than 3 million of these folks, say, in the public K-12 system, it's a really big and a really significant challenge. And it's not clear that we're going to be able to do this by tweaking and working within our traditional arrangements. So what we've tried to do is think about how do you do this differently. Now, that actually raises two questions, particularly in the context in which we like to talk about scientifically based research. There's really two propositions on the table. One is that if you pay people for performance or pay them for merit or pay them for skills or compensated groups, that you're going to get better short-term performance. So, for instance, in the paper, Susan and Mark allude to what some folks regard as optimistic results from Denver, say, from the 99 to 02 period. I think it was 99-02, the first cut, which is fine. But that actually misses the point. That's not what we're talking about. The argument for rethinking compensation systems is not whether or not the Texas plan, for instance, actually leads to short-term bumps in tax scores in low SES Texas schools. The argument for rethinking compensation is that as we look 5, 10, 20 years out, that we're going to attract and keep the kinds of people we want in those schools, that we're going to reshape the human capital that's leading schools and that's staffing classrooms. Now, we don't have good immediate short-term metrics. It's not something we're going to be able to check with year-over-year achievement gains. What we need are different metrics, which actually capture the stuff we care about. We don't have those at the moment, so there's a real danger that the whole conversation is going to get reduced to do these plans give you some kind of reliable and valid coefficient suggesting a short-term bump in grade 3 to 8 math or reading scores. It's not the right question. So as we talk about this stuff, we need to avoid allowing the data we have stand in for the conversation we should have. Third thing is that because educators like to think about programmatic solutions, when folks like Alan have studied this stuff and talked about it historically, we've talked about what are the right compensation models. So when you look at the research going back 20 or 30 years by, you know, the best education researchers, what we're trying to do is figure out what are the skills and knowledge we should pay for. What is the right kind of compensation system? What is the right kind of group pay? This isn't the right question, actually. I mean, we understand why we go there. But the real thing, if you look at, you look at sectors in the American economy, you look at sectors internationally, you look at those pockets where you get really good people, partly by leveraging things like compensation and work conditions, it's not like anybody has a recipe. It's not like the Google guys were able to build the team they did, or the YouTube guys, or the folks at Microsoft, or Oracle, or Dell. Anybody who's attracting smart, dynamic people and getting them to work hard and put in a lot of time and do their best. It's not like they're doing this because they have the right recipe for compensation, and if we could just mimic that. The right recipe for compensation depends on who you're trying to attract. I mean, Howard's slides kind of alluded to this, the different attrition rates across nations. Mark and Susan certainly talk about this a lot as they're talking about different nations. Mm-hmm. If we're trying to attract people who are in their 20s to do certain kinds of work, the kinds of compensation that are going to be effective are probably different than if we're trying to attract people who are married and settled and have three kids and are in their 40s and are changing careers. It's not like there is a right and a wrong compensation model. There are compensation models that will help attract and motivate the people we're trying to motivate and attract. And we need to start thinking and talking about it that way. And that brings us to kind of the final point that I'll close on, which is this is a conversation that's by definition really hard to have when we're talking about public sector. When we talk about public sector or conventionally unionized industries, what we tend to want is the right model in place. This is why civil service pay reform is very difficult, not just in education, but those, we live in D.C., we read the Washington Post. We know this happens where you, whether you're trying to do it at DOD, whether you're trying to do it in HHS. Like, these are general problems of the fact that when you have the federal government or a state government or a local government administering pay scales, there's enormous concerns that these be equitable and fair and careful and statutorily prescriptive and appropriately regulated and the rest. Unfortunately, the truth is hardly any systems like this anywhere in the world have proven really, really effective at seeking out talent, particularly in the new age, where the best, most dynamic folks that we probably want to disproportionately recruit from aren't necessarily looking for what they're going to be doing 15 years out or 30 years out, but are looking at where they're going to have an opportunity to make a big difference and be rewarded if they do 3 years and 5 years and 8 years out. And the problem is that statutory collective systems aren't real well designed for that. So one of the things we're going to need to think about going forward is not only what would the right system look like if we could somehow possibly imagine a way to get those things through Congress or state legislatures and to get them collectively bargained, but we also need to think about is that even a feasible approach to making the kinds of changes we need to think about? And if not, what does that imply for how we want to govern school operations and compensation scales in the way we think about divvying up money? Just bottom line, you'd have to work real hard to convince me that anybody has a compensation system that in, from any kind of skeptical policy perspective, is fair or right or rational. Mostly what they have are systems that work. What they do is they factor in a lot of stuff that relates to merit, stuff that relates to performance, stuff that relates to group performance, but also has a whole lot of intuition and a whole lot of managerial prerogative. And any reasonable person can look at this stuff, whether we're talking about, you know, whether we're talking about GM or FedEx, and say that's not entirely fair. I don't think that's a right system that one should impose across the board and be comfortable with the results. But the fact is, it tends to work for them because this kind of flexibility creates the right incentives over the long haul, and it tends to average out, and you tend to get the best people sticking around because they feel valued. And it's, I think, an open question whether state-run, heavily regulated compensation systems can be jimmied into that kind of shape.